This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. Breast cancer is the most common cancer among women in Malaysia, yet there has never been a true assessment of breast cancer risk among Malaysian women. But why is it important to know our specific risk? I'm going to find out from Associate Professor Dr. Ho Wing Kee, statistician, as well as Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer of Cancer Research Malaysia, and they are both the co-lead authors of a groundbreaking genetic study that was carried out by Cancer Research Malaysia and the University of Cambridge, and very recently published. So how are you both today?
Very good. Nice to see you again, Xiao Ik.
That's right.
I'm good. Thank you for having me today.
And nice to have you finally, Prof Teo, in the studio. We did catch up during the start of the MCO, I think, talking about the impact of sort of the lockdown on cancer research. And looking ahead as well, what would be the impact of that?
Right? Absolutely, shall we? It was really nice to be able to catch up with you over the telephone and do that interview at that point, talking about what is the impact of COVID on cancer patients, and particularly on our studies looking at low-income cancer patients and what impact it might have on their adherence to treatment as well as the timeliness of their care. But that's not the topic for today. So.
No, but I did want to ask, now that we are easing out of the lockdowns, in the recovery phase, have things gotten any better for your research?
I think certainly for the patients who are in treatment already or who already have been diagnosed with disease, I think, you know, things are slowly coming back to operation, and the Ministry of Health have done an excellent job at balancing the control of COVID infection as well as re-establishment of services for patients. But I think where we're going to see long-standing effects on cancer that we really don't know yet is in the early diagnosis of cancer and the patients who are attending screening. Because I think for screening, most people consider that as an optional extra and not something that you definitely need to attend. So people are putting that off. And because symptom recognition in the Malaysian population is just so poor and health education and health awareness remains relatively low, I think I'm going to be concerned about what the impact might be in the short term on early diagnosis of cancer in the absence of screening and awareness of cancer signs and symptoms.
And we know that early diagnosis and identification enables early treatment.
Absolutely.
Which is what we are lacking right now, because we are seeing a lot of late stage of diagnosis, right?
Absolutely. So unfortunately, one of the challenges that Malaysia faces with many other low and middle income countries, especially in Asia, is a majority of patients still present with late stage disease. So in Malaysia, somewhere between 60 to 70% of patients present with late stage disease. And as we know, you know, for a disease like breast cancer, for example, if you present with stage 4 disease, your 5-year survival is about 20%, whereas if you present with stage 1 disease, it's 95%. So that's such a big difference, right? So from 19% to 95%. So what we really need to make sure is that we shift more and more individuals from the late stage of detection to early stage of detection. And to some extent, that's possible through recognition of the signs and symptoms of cancer. But a major part of that is actually through early detection through screening. And screening means offering, you know, screening tools to individuals who don't have any symptoms of cancer. And this is a major part of what we need to be able to do to advance cancer control in our country and in our population.
Can we set the context in order to understand how common breast cancer is in Malaysia? What are the trends and statistics showing us about prevalence and risk?
Yeah. So I think that's a great question, Xiao Ik. I think in the past, the Asian population used to have a lower risk of cancer compared to the Western population. But with urbanization, with changes in our lifestyle factors, from the number of children that we have to the age at which we have children and so on, our risk of cancer is increasing rapidly. So the World Health Organization came out with a study that estimates that from 2012 to 2025, the number of cancer cases in Malaysia is going to increase by 49%. I'm going to repeat that. From 2012 to 2025, the number of breast cancer cases in Malaysia is anticipated to rise by up to 49%. That's a huge increase, and probably one of the largest projected increase in the Asia-Pacific region. So in a sense, we need to be able to make sure that that tide is going to happen. We need to make sure that we can at least catch them at an early stage when breast cancer is really a curable disease. And we want to make sure that we are able to get the message out there to change behaviour so that women women who are at elevated risk do attend screening, and women who are at average risk know what they need to do in terms of recognizing the signs and symptoms of cancer, so that if cancer does occur to them, they can present at an early stage.
All right. But why this increase?
Well, it's driven by many factors. I think the biggest one is, of course, change of reproductive factors. You know, in 1968, on average, women had 6 children per woman, whereas today our life, you know, our birth rate has dropped dramatically, right? It's sort of, in the Chinese population, it's barely just over 1 child per woman, whereas in the Malay and in the Indian population, it's still 2 point something per woman. But that decrease means that we have almost a doubling in increased risk of cancer in our generation compared to the older generation. That's number one. The second is other factors that are associated, such as urbanization, exercise, physical activity. You know, physical activity is one of the modifiable risk factors for breast cancer, and certainly associated particularly with increased risk to postmenopausal breast cancer. So it's an intervention that's very important. And then something that we don't really think about is the effect of urbanization and changed lifestyles in our daughters. So for example, it's been shown that in the past 2 generations, the age at which girls start to have their periods has gone down from 18 in our grandmother's generation to, you know, about 16 or 14 in our parents' generation to about 12 in our generation. And nowadays in my daughter's generation, for example, some kids are starting to have their periods when they're in standard 4. Yeah. And that's only 10 years old. That's so right. The reality is every year of decrease in their age of menarche, the age at which they start periods, is associated with a higher risk of cancer. Mm. So it's actually, you know, even behaviours that are taking place very early on in life is modifying our risk of developing breast cancer.
All right. Dr. Ho, you're a statistician.
Yes.
Where does your research intersect with this issue of breast cancer?
So, like you say, I'm a statistician by training, and then most of my research actually mainly focus on, trying to use statistics to understand, you know, how disease evolve or what are the determinants of different disease. So, and then here's where I get involved with Cancer Research Malaysia about 5 years ago, mm-hmm. where I met Sue for the first time, I think it was 7 years ago, and then she was telling me about all these plans, you know, that Cancer Research Malaysia wanted to do. And then one of the questions that I really remember that you say, you know, the question that we're asking is, how can we come up with a better breast cancer control plan for Malaysian women, where currently we are actually not having any particular strategy on saying who should go for screening, who is at higher risk, and, you know, what is the appropriate management strategy. So in terms of this study, what we are doing is really I'm trying to contribute my knowledge in statistics, trying to use combine all these genetic marker that we know that will increase the risk of breast cancer, throw them all into one equation and trying to come up with a score. And this score, based on this score, we can classify women into different risk group, and from there we can, better recommend the the breast cancer screening strategy for women, particularly women who are at a much higher risk of the disease.
All right. Yeah. So that's the study that I mentioned earlier that was carried out by Cancer Research Malaysia and the University of Cambridge, right? So we'll get into sort of more about how you carried out that study and what do the findings actually mean a little later. But Dr. Ho, since you deal with numbers, I need your help to help me understand numbers. So I've read that a woman in Malaysia has a 1 in 20 chance of developing breast cancer in her lifetime. Now, correct me if those statistics are wrong, but also, what does this actually mean for me?
Okay, so I would say at this point, it just means that all of us are the same.
It's difficult to understand because oftentimes a breast cancer patient will ask me, I either have it or I don't. So surely it's either a 1 or a 0. I either have 100%, I have the disease, or I don't have the disease. How can I have a 5% of the disease? What does that actually mean? I think the point is it's one of probability, right? It's a probability. You know, if you take any group of 20 individuals, one of them will develop breast cancer. So if you have a town of 100,000 individuals, for example, then 5,000 of those would develop breast cancer. So it's basically to kind of say that when you have a certain grouping of individuals, how many of them will develop breast cancer? And the risk in the Asian population is lower than that in the Caucasian population. If you look at the US, it's 1 in 8. If you look at Australia, it's 1 in 9. If you look at Malaysia, it's 1 in 20. So the Asian population has a lower risk of developing cancer.
All right.
The challenge is, how do you tell whether you are that 1 or
yes,
you're the 19,
exactly.
Right? How are you going to tell whether you're in the pot that you're going to develop the cancer or not? And in the past, a lot of the genetic analyses that enable us to do so was on high-risk genes, like I'm sure you've heard of BRCA1 and BRCA2, because these were made famous by Angelina Jolie when she declared that she had undergone a prophylactic mastectomy because she inherited a BRCA1 gene. And today, I think what we're here to tell you about is not about the BRCA1 gene, but about other genetic elements, the ones that are found in most individuals. They're very common in the population, and they are not associated with families that have multiple cancer cases, but actually associated with, they are found in everybody in the population. So this is really about population risk of cancer and how do we remove that uncertainty of whether you're going to be the one that develops cancer or you're in the group that is very unlikely to develop cancer. How do we begin to offer a more accurate estimate of risk to all women out there?
That's what struck me when you asked 1 in 19, what does that mean to me? I almost say it actually means nothing apart from, you know, that you have 5% chance of getting the disease in your lifetime. Without additional tool, knowing more about the genetic, knowing more about the family, your lifestyle, family history, we can't tell much. That's all we can do, 1 in 20. And like you say, we don't know whether you're the 1 or whether you're the 19.
Mm. So I hope that your study gives us a bit more answers to these questions that you've raised. I'm speaking today to Associate Professor Dr. Ho Wing Kee, statistician, as well as Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia. They're here to explain more about a genetic study that they have just carried out and that has just been published, looking at the risk of breast cancer among Asian women. So we'll go for a quick break now, and when we come back, we will find out more about this study. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Yik. I have with me statistician, Associate Professor Dr. Ho Wing Kee, as well as Chief Scientific Officer from Cancer Research Malaysia, Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang. And they are the co-lead authors of a groundbreaking genetic study that was carried out by Cancer Research Malaysia and the University of Cambridge. It's groundbreaking because for the first time, it has looked at a big sample of Asian women in order to better understand the risk of breast cancer in the Asian population versus the Caucasian population, where a lot more information, or the European population, where a lot more information had previously been available, but we have not known as much about Asian women. So, Dr. Ho, perhaps you could explain what was the motivation to look at the Asian population and how was this study carried out?
So, we know that Asian population are genetically very different compared to the European population. So our DNA codes consists of 3 billion alphabets, where about 99.9% of them are actually identical between you and me. But this 0.1% where they are different is where it holds the clue of, you know, a lot of things like why you're taller and I'm shorter, and why some people are more prone to certain disease but some people are not. Because of their genetic, because European and Asian are genetically very different from each other, this means that, you know, how likely one is going to develop breast cancer could be different as well. So in the European population, there have already been a lot of studies showing that there are genetic markers that spread across the genome that are at increased that will increase this risk of breast cancer if you carry some of them. So far, about 313 of them have been shown to elevate the risk of breast cancer. But we don't know about Asian. At the point before our study, we actually don't know whether women in Asia who also carry some of these genetic mutation, are they also at an increased risk at breast cancer? So what we're doing in this study is we look at 45,000 women, and then we are trying to, what we did is we compute their score based on these 300 genetic markers. As I said earlier, we put them into a mathematical equation and try to look at their score and see whether they discriminate between the breast cancer patient and the healthy woman in the study or not. I think this is the first time. For the first time, we show that using this set of score actually can help to provide women an accurate estimate of their breast cancer risk. So earlier you asked about 1 in 20 would develop breast cancer in Malaysia. Actually, in our study, we showed that if based on the genetic risk score, we categorize women in the different risk group, as I explained earlier. Those in the highest risk group actually have 1 in 6 chance of developing breast cancer in their lifetime. Mm. So that would mean that out of all these women who are categorized into the highest risk group, 1 in 6 of them will get the disease in their lifetime.
And the highest risk is determined by whether they carry those genetic mutations.
Absolutely, right. Yeah. So why is this, you know, really important to follow through? Is really because if you think about it, 5%, 1 in 20, sounds like such an insignificant number. Mm-hmm. And you kind of hope it's not me. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to hope that I'm the 19 out of the 20 that are not going to develop the disease. But if you know that you have an 87% chance of developing breast cancer, you will want to consider prophylactic mastectomy. You know, you might want to consider that. If you know that you have a 30% chance of developing cancer, you might want to consider having screening or some healthcare interventions that could potentially reduce your risk. You might consider chemo prevention, for example. But on the other hand, if you are a 1 in 6 chance of developing breast cancer, then screening starts to matter, because at least you know that if you have developed breast cancer, you can detect it in an earlier stage. Mm-hmm. And that's when breast cancer is most highly likely to be curable. And that's our intent. Our intent is to provide women with the type of information that Angelina Jolie had access to, so that we can empower Asian women to ensure that they take up the screening that's necessary for them.
Does that risk tell you about whether a woman would carry those BRCA genes, for instance, certain more rare forms of breast cancer?
Yeah, there are many different types of genetic tests, Xiaoyik. And that's a really great point. We actually have another study that's about to be reported, and I hope to come back and tell you more about that on another day. But this other study actually started to analyze, you know, 34 genes that were previously either known or presumed to be associated with an increased risk to breast cancer at a much more significant level. So it's at the 87%, 65%, 45% level. But these are genes which are very rare. So they only occur in 1 in 1,000 individuals, 1 in 50,000 individuals, exquisitely rare. The genes or genetic elements that we're talking about today are very common. They're found in half of the population. So each one of these variants are very common, and each one of us probably on average has about 5 of them. Right?
Okay.
But 5 of them doesn't cause us many problems. So instead of having a 5% chance of developing breast cancer, it might be a 5.5% chance or 6% chance of developing breast cancer. But it's when you have a constellation of them, maybe out of the 313, you have 150 that randomly are present in you, even though your parents don't have that many of them, but the combination of it in one individual seems to be associated with risk. So I think it's that combination of those genetic loci that are very common in the population, that generates a tool that we can begin to use at a population-wide level, not just among the individuals that have strong family history of breast cancer.
All right. But Dr. Ho, how do you use something like this at the population level? Is it talking about looking at the genetic makeup of every woman?
So as I say, it forms the DNA code is formed by 3 billion alphabet. So this is what we do, what we call the sequencing. When you do the sequencing, you can read the whole genome of a woman. But what we are talking about here is really you can just panel testing the 300 genetic markers that we are interested. And then, how do you say, you just need some blood or a swab in your mouth, and then being able to read the genetic marker across this, where it's spread across the different location in your genome. And each of these, instead of saying I have 5, you have 10, somebody have 150 out of 300, we combine them using the tool that we call the polygenic risk score, which is the study that we publish. And the output of this tool actually gives you a score instead of counting on how many do we have. Mm. So that kind of summarizes on what does it mean when you have 150? What does it mean in terms of your lifetime risk of developing breast cancer?
All right.
Sometimes analogies are really useful, shall we? So I'm going to try this analogy and see whether that works. You know, so for example, if I wanted to give you an indication of where I am at the moment without telling you the location, I might be able to send you pictures of different locations of Taman Tun or Wan Utama. Mm-hmm. And just by by sending you a picture of, you know, One Utama Shopping Centre and Centre Point, mm-hmm. you probably would know roughly where I am anyway, mm-hmm. right? So in this, I don't need to send you pictures of every single house in Bandar Utama to be able to tell you where I am. In the same way, instead of looking at the entire genome of an individual, every single house in that particular location, mm-hmm. I can just look at two or three markers and I'll be able to tell you what your risk of cancer is. Mm-hmm. So that basically means it's a much cheaper test, a genetic test that only tests 313 markers, 313 mm-hmm. alphabets, would enable us to be able to give a woman what her estimated risk of breast cancer is.
Okay. All right. But we, even in Malaysia itself or any other Asian country, we are still ethnically diverse within our population.
Great question, Xiaoyi. Yeah. So that was one of the top things that we were asked by our scientific reviewers. You know, so what we were asked is, can the tool that we have evaluated work equally well in the Chinese, Malay and Indian population, mm-hmm. right? And even beyond that, you know, we need to think about genetic diversity beyond these three major ethnic groups in Malaysia. What about the Iban, the Kadazans and so on, right? There's so much richness and diversity in Malaysia. So I leave Yuki to tell us a little bit about the predictive power of the polygenic risk score in different ethnic groups.
That's a unique of this study. So we have 45,000 women in the study, where 16,000 of them actually coming from Malaysia and Singapore. Mm-hmm. So so we had a unique opportunity to look at how does these two perform in each of these ethnic subgroups. So in this study, we actually look at the predictive power of this polygenic risk score by Malay, Indian, and also Chinese ethnicity. So what we have shown in the study is, this tool is actually useful. It can be used to predict the risk equally well in all three ethnicity, as long as we do some stats trick and takes into account the unique distribution of the genetic risk score in each of these ethnic groups.
It's not one in which we can just take the European data and plonk it and use it as it was used in the European population, just in the Asian population. That's the reason why statisticians like Yuki are really important, because it's about applying that knowledge and transforming it in a way that can be translated to be used in our own population that's really significant, right? And such studies like this one is only possible because, you know, in the first place, Cancer Research Malaysia worked with University of Malaya and Subang Jaya Medical Center to set up a very large cohort of breast cancer patients as well as controls in Malaysia. Then we did the equivalent by collaborating with researchers and scientists in Singapore. And then we collaborated with the scientists in the University of Cambridge and brought in Yuki stats experts from the University of Nottingham here in Malaysia. And it's that collaborative opportunity that enables us to make major milestones in terms of being able to advance cancer research so that it's not just applied to the European population. You know, before we started, something like nearly 90% of genetic studies in breast cancer were conducted in the European population. And it was almost lip service to do anything in the Asian population, right? Mm. So we're actually really pleased that, you know, we set out a goal to say that we're going to put Malaysia on the map. We're going to put Asians on the map and make sure that Asians are not left out in the fight against cancer, and that Malaysians in some small organization and some remote area can still work with the best scientists in the world to make an important discovery that hopefully will translate to better better services for our own population.
So coming back to the question of the different ethnic groups, say Malaysia and Singapore, where we are quite similar, if I were to ask, is there a difference in the genetic risk between Malay women and Chinese women, does this score give you that answer?
Yes. So what we find is that the score, genes and our environment do interact, right? So every ethnic group has a different population risk of developing breast cancer. So in Malaysia, Chinese have the highest risk of developing breast cancer compared to the Malay and the Indian population. And the Malays have the lowest risk of developing cancer. We know that a lot of this reason why the Malays have a lower risk of developing breast cancer is because of the reproductive factors associated in the Malay population, where Malay women are more likely to have children at a younger age and to have more children and to breastfeed them for longer. Mm-hmm. You know, I was very proud of myself when I breastfed my first child for 18 months until I had a catch-up coffee with my best friend, and she's basically said, 18 months? I went off for 4 years. I was like, Okay.
I'm not going to reveal anything here. Then.
But I think the point is that there are population differences in the environmental factors that changes our baseline risk of cancer. And genetics is something that adds on top of that. It's another layer. So in other words, if your starting risk is low, genetics amplifies that and makes your risk higher. Uh-huh. But if in the population, your risk in the Malay population is lower to begin with, then the genetic factors, add on the genetic factors, the environment plus genetics, means that the lifetime risk for a Malay woman is still lower than the environment plus genetics in a Chinese woman, because her baseline from the environmental factors was already higher to begin with.
Okay. So then does this study suggest or compel changes in our behavior in order to, if we can't change our genetics, can we change the environmental factors?
We hope so.
We hope that, I think Sue already mentioned earlier, being able to provide an accurate risk of getting the disease to women, meaning that they'll be more aware. You know, they'll be more aware that they are at higher risk. They may want to live more healthier, do more exercise. I mean, having more children if possible, but of course it's not.
Or breastfeed them for longer.
Longer. Yeah. And to attend mammographic screening, to adhere to the screening schedule that's recommended by doctor.
I think, maybe it's useful to consider a before and after picture, right? So what is it before this genetic test is available, and what might screening practices look like after the availability of this genetic test? Mm-hmm. So before screening is available, we treat every woman as her risk is the same. So we tell them, at 50, your risk is such that we warrant that you attend screening. Right? Doesn't matter whether you had your period starting at 16 or at 11. Doesn't matter whether you have 5 children or none. It doesn't matter whether you breastfed them or not. We tell everyone you start screening at the age of 50. And the reason is because all of those lifestyle factors cannot be put into a model that accurately tells a woman, here's your risk of developing breast cancer. We just consider them risk factors, but no model has been shown to incorporate this in a way that accurately tells a woman, here's your individual risk score. Mm-hmm. That's the difference with genetics. In a genetic risk score, we can tell an individual woman, this is your risk of developing cancer. It's 16%, it's 30%, it's 87%. So that precision enables us to test for the first time information which wasn't available previously. If we're able to tell a woman your risk of cancer is 30%, can we now encourage every woman whose risk is 30% to attend screening? If we can do that, I think that we will be able to get more women to present with earlier stage disease when it is a curable disease. And that's our goal. Our goal is to make sure that if as a country we cannot afford to offer screening to every woman because of cost and because of the concerns of overdiagnosis, can we at least make sure that the individuals who are at elevated risk receive the screening that is appropriate for them? And this is what we call a risk stratified strategy. Sounds like a geek kingdom talk, but it's absolutely that, right? A risk stratified strategy means that instead of treating everyone as equal in terms of their risk, which is not the right strategy, can we at least offer screening to the individuals at elevated risk to make sure that we can save lives through the early detection of cancer in these individuals?
But as a baseline, you still need every woman to have that genetic test done?
Yeah, so that's the concern, right? When should we do that genetic test? Right? And this is a very big challenge. You know, one in which, Xiaoyi, to be really honest, I haven't really found, Yuki and I have been brainstorming this for 2 years, and we haven't really found a solution to that yet. Because in the West, you know, countries like in Europe, for example, as well as the US, they've moved ahead. What they're doing now is they have population-wide screening strategies. So in the Netherlands, close to 90% of people attend screening. In the US, you know, maybe only about 60% attend screening. But they have a screening strategy. So what they're doing is when women attend screening, they take a DNA swab and then they tell a woman, are you at very high risk, moderate high risk, or low risk, and then they can tailor the screening strategy according to those individuals. But how do you do this in a country where there's no screening in the first place? You know, if you look at our population, there are 650 million people living in Southeast Asia. 650 million people living in Southeast Asia, and only the 5 million in Singapore have access to population-based screening for breast cancer and cervical cancer and colorectal cancer. So what do you do with the remaining 645 million people? Currently, there's no screening strategy. So how do you introduce risk-stratified approaches when you don't know how to do population-based screening? So we've been thinking about services that Malaysia and other developing countries do very well. And one of the things that we should be really proud of is Malaysia was actually one of the first countries to introduce maternal health and improvements mm-hmm. in maternal health incredibly rapidly post-war mm-hmm. and able to achieve a reduction in mortality for under fives very significantly. So we need to think about how do we build that on top of that? How do we build screening strategies or personalized awareness of cancer risk into that system? And we haven't figured it out yet, but watch this space. We hope to be able to come back and tell you more about it.
Because if you say cost of breast cancer screening is a hindrance, if you look at cervical cancer screening, previously pap smear tests are even cheaper, and yet the uptake was very low. So is it cost or is it attitude?
There's a lot of factors, Xiaoyik. You know, it's a lot of cancer. A lot of women tell me, they give me this example. They say, you know, it's like Michael Schumacher. You teach Michael Schumacher, you know, don't think wall. Don't even think the alphabets, W-A-L-L. Because if you think that, you're going to hit the wall, right? Mm-hmm. So many times, you know, women will say, well, if I go for screening, sure, they will find something. And then I have to go for treatment and so on. Yeah. Whereas if I don't, you know, I'll be okay, right? That's that sense of denial and also sense of distrust of the healthcare system, that the healthcare system is out to make a quick buck from them in some way, mm-hmm. right? But there's also that sense of forlorn, if you like, worry about whether it's really a curable disease or not. If we're able to get out there, that the majority of breast cancers are curable at an early stage and people really believe that they have access to that, they might change our attitudes towards screening. So I don't think that it's a one-size-fits-all. I think the genetics part takes us one step closer to having better cancer control and better offering of screening services. But we still need to think about how do we integrate it into the healthcare system? How do we change the behaviours of individuals? And that's right. A mammoth task ahead of us.
That's right. So Dr. Ho, what comes next?
So we talk about genetic, and then we talk about how genetic actually interact with lifestyle factors. That's where Sue already explained actually how all this should really go into one comprehensive model where you can provide even more accurate breast cancer risk estimate to women. I think in terms of changing behavior, we do really hope that being able to tell you your personalized risk, not telling you that one in 20 will get it, is going to help in changing the behavior.
So in the short term, what Cancer Research Malaysia is doing is really working with statisticians like Yuki to improve the model. So with University of Cambridge, University of Nottingham and many others, and National University of Singapore and so on, what we're trying to do is improve the model by adding not just the common variants that we've identified in this study, but the rare variants that I'll come back and tell you more about next time, but also the mammographic density measures. Remember earlier in this year, we talked also about what is mammographic density. Yes. So we're incorporating those, and finally, the lifestyle factors. We're going to build a great model that incorporates all of these specific for the Asian population so that we can really be able to be fairly accurate in telling women what their individual risk of cancer is. But the next step for us is really to roll this out into the population. Mm-hmm. We have in plans an implementation study to look at a web app tool that will enable women to access this type of information for themselves and hopefully figure out whether that changes the behaviour of women. But our big challenge there is really one of donation. Cancer Research Malaysia is funded entirely by donations, and one of the collateral damage, if you like, of COVID-19 was that the funding available to all charities, including Cancer Research Malaysia, is very limited. So I'm, to be honest, really worried because the research grant environment is very, very challenging at the moment, because in the grant world, most of the funding is going to COVID-related research. And in a charitable world, a lot of the funding is going to deal with poverty and just access to schooling and so on, mm-hmm. which are very worthy causes. So how do we take forward some of these things? You know, I suppose this is where an appeal to the public is really important. Don't forget Cancer Research Malaysia the next time you are thinking about a donation. Mm-hmm. And sorry for plugging it in. I can't leave without putting in a plug. But I think it's really important that hopefully we continue to put Asians on the map, making sure that the technological advances that are being made in the fight against cancer don't leave out Asians.
I like how you very smoothly inserted that in, actually. but so you're looking at basically building a library, almost a database, with all the possible potential genetic mutations that can, more and more accurately, as with each step that you take, improve that precision of predicting risk, right?
Absolutely, Xiaoyi. I didn't think we would get here. You know, Cancer Research Malaysia, you know, I came back from Cambridge to set this up, and then I came back fully in 2006. But I think where we are now is this is now the largest study of Asians in the world. So the 45,000 individuals is the largest and first study in Malaysians. And who would have thought that two little Malaysians led mm-hmm. that study with a whole team of investigators, you know, and doctors from the hospitals and so on behind us in order to be able to lead this. The next step, I think the future is bright in terms of ability to be able to continue to lead this area and make sure that we continue to improve the models. But we continue, I think the next step is what I find really challenging as well as promising, is to kind of figure out how do we translate this to save more lives. Mm-hmm. I think that's the next phase and one that I'm really looking forward to.
Dr. Ho, we already have some form of those genetic profile tests that are commercially available. Is that on the horizon in this context where, you know, one day you could have a mail order DNA test and it could look through this library of genetic mutations and I could get my individualized score that way?
I believe Yes. There are a lot of commercial tests that offer you, that really mail you that. I think all you have to do is to take DNA sample swab, and then you will get a report. But I believe those are mainly on established genetic mutation that are known to increase the risk of breast cancer. For example, the BRCA mutation. So in terms of all these genetic markers that are very common to the population that we talk about, I don't think that there's any out there yet. Even if, I mean, that you can get it. You probably can get your result for the 300, but whether you'll be able to make sense of it or not is a different story. And most importantly, I think whatever that's out there, it's for European populations.
Absolutely. If you actually look at a report, and I've seen one of these reports from a US-based company, they'll put there, you know, this is the... Of course, they'll ask you for what your ethnicity is when you submit the sample, but they'll put it in a report, this is what your risk is, but estimates in the Asian population are very wide because of insufficient studies. So I think our study is actually going to contribute to these commercial companies because they now can take the data from our publication and be able to provide more accurate risk estimates to Asians, even living in the US. Mm. You know, so who would have thought that a study that was conducted in little old Malaysia can ultimately make its way into a clinical report that's presented by a commercial genetic testing company in the US? And this is definitely going to be the way forward.
All right. Do you have a final message for us?
I think our message is really fairly simple to Malaysian women out there. Number one is risk of breast cancer is increasing. And so certainly be aware of the signs and symptoms of breast cancer. And don't be afraid to get those symptoms checked out. Because more often than not, 9 out of 10 lumps are not cancer, but you can't tell just by feeling. Go and get it checked out. And if you do get cancer, the reality is early stage cancer is almost 100% curable now. But even late-stage cancer, survival is improving significantly. So the message out there to all women is definitely go and get yourself checked out if you have a sign and symptom. If you don't have a sign or symptom and you have family history of breast cancer, anyone in your family that's related to you with breast cancer, go and find out more. Screening is appropriate for you. And perhaps in the next few years, take part in our research studies and come and find out more about what Cancer Research Malaysia is doing and take part in our events or make us a donation. Do whatever you can to ensure that we can ensure that the fight against cancer doesn't miss Asians.
Yeah. Dr. Ho?
That's what I was going to say. The last bit that I want to say is really support support cancer research, you know, support medical research. I think Angelina Jolie's like make the BRCA mutation famous. There's one of the story where how the fruits of scientific research actually can help to impact life. Mm. I think our study is another study to show that, you know, how the fruit of medical research, maybe when you do the donation or when you participate in the study, you will not, you probably think that, you know, this is not relevant to me, but it's really something that's going to impact the future generation. So do support cancer research and, you know, try to help us to move forward.
It's like it's like the famous Neil Armstrong words, isn't it? By contributing in any small way, it's one small step for man or humans, I suppose, but it could contribute to a giant leap for mankind.
What a nice way to sum it up, Shaoyik. Yeah. I'm going to make you brand ambassador.
All right. Thank you so much. I've been speaking to Associate Professor Dr. Ho Wing Kee, statistician, as well as Professor Dr. Teo Su Huang, Chief Scientific Officer of Cancer Research Malaysia. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.